welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. It may be early December days yet, but my goal is to keep you one step ahead. Today, we'll get a jump on a special year-end best-of list. Each year, the esteemed editors at Publishers Weekly look back at the nearly 9,000 titles they've reviewed over the course of the year, and they pick their favorites. Voila! Today's show features their fabulous finds in fiction and nonfiction. Hopefully, you may be able to carve out some reading time for yourself during these hectic days. And it's possible you're still searching for a thoughtful gift for the literary folks on your list. So let's begin as we turn to page one of the book report. When the San Jose mine in Chile collapsed in August 2010, it trapped 33 miners beneath thousands of feet of rock for a record-breaking 69 days. Across the globe, the world sat riveted to TV and computer screens. While viewers saw what transpired above ground during the grueling rescue, the story of the miners' experiences below the Earth's surface and the lives that led them there has not been heard until now. Deep Down Dark, by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Hector Tobar, offers exclusive access to the miners and their stories. The result is an emotionally textured account of the 33 men who came to think of the San Jose mine as a kind of coffin, and as a church where they sought redemption through prayer while the world watched from above. It also offers the personal histories that brought Los 33 to the mine. Henry Leva narrates.
The San Jose mine is located inside a round, rocky, and lifeless mountain in the Atacama Desert in Chile. Wind is slowly eroding the surface of the mountain into a fine grayish-orange powder that flows downhill and gathers in pools and dunes. The sky above the mine is azure and empty, allowing an unimpeded sun to bake the moisture from the soil. Only once every dozen years or so does a storm system worthy of the name sweep across the desert to drop rain on the San Jose property. The dust is then transformed into mud, as thick as freshly poured concrete. Few sightseers visit this corner of the Atacama, though the naturalist Charles Darwin did pass nearby, briefly, during his 19th century journey around the world on a Royal Navy research vessel. The locals told him scientifically implausible stories that link the rare rains to earthquakes. The vastness of Atacama and the absence of animal life surprised Darwin, and in his journal he described the desert as a barrier far worse than the most turbulent ocean. Even today, birders who pass through this part of Chile note that there are few, if any, avian species to be found. In the deeper desert, the only conspicuous living presence is of mining men and the occasional woman riding in trucks and minibuses to the mountains where there is gold, copper, and iron to be extracted. The wealth of minerals under the barren hills draws workers to the Atacama mines from the nearby city of Copiapó and from many other distant corners of Chile. Juan Carlos Aguilar travels the farthest to reach the San Jose, more than 1,000 miles. The shape of Chile on a map is that of a snake, and Aguilar's trek to work takes him along half the snake's body. His weekly commute begins in the temperate rainforests of southern Chile. At the mine, he supervises a team of 3 men who repair front loaders and the squat, long-armed, insect-like vehicles known as jumbos during a 7-day shift that begins on Thursday morning. But his ride to work starts 36 hours earlier on Tuesday evening in the town of Los Lagos. No local job pays as well as his gig in the desert, so he settles his weary, middle-aged body into a Pullman bus and watches as the shadows of beech forests, eucalyptus tree farms, and mountain rivers pass by his window. The weather matches his mood. The sky is overcast and raindrops beat on the windows, as they usually do when he sets out for work. The average precipitation in the region of Chile he calls home, at the 40th parallel of the southern hemisphere, is 102 inches a year. One of the mechanics in the supervisor's three-man crew lives somewhat closer to the mine. Raúl Bustos leaves for work from the port city of Talcahuano, near the 37th parallel. A tsunami struck Talcahuano 5 months earlier, triggered by an 8.8 magnitude earthquake. The disaster killed more than 500 people, left the city covered with pools of ocean water in which thousands of fish flopped about, and washed out the Navy base where he used to work. Bustos is a punctilious father of two and devoted husband. He boards a bus heading northward, then travels along a flat landscape filled with greenhouses, tractors, and the fallow and cultivated fields of Chile's agricultural heartland. He passes through the town of Chillán, where another member of Aguilar's crew begins his own journey northward, and then through Talca, where a tall and devoutly Christian jumbo operator boards yet another bus. The men who work inside the San Jose mine are divided into two shifts, A and B, each working 7 days at a time, and all these men have been assigned to the A shift. The A shift, in turn, is divided into 12-hour-long night and day shifts that keep the mine working around the clock, from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. to the following 8 a.m.
We've just heard Deep Down Dark by Hector Tobar. In The Dog, Joseph O'Neill has created a tale of alienation and heartbreak in Dubai. Distraught by a breakup with his long-term girlfriend, our unnamed hero leaves New York to take an unusual job in a strange desert metropolis. In Dubai, at the height of its self-invention as a futuristic Shangri-La, he struggles with his new position as the family officer of the very rich Batros family. Reviewers call this title, performed by Eric Davies, a comic and philosophically profound exploration of what has become of humankind's moral progress.
It was there, by the supposedly holographic waterfall, that we reminisced about the year we lived in a Dublin house occupied by college students who had in common only that we were not Irish. Aside from me and Eddie, there was a Belgian and an Englishman and a Greek. Eddie and I were not by any stretch great pals, but we had, as an adventitious link, the French language. I spoke it because of my francophone Swiss mother. Eddie, because he'd grown up in that multilingual Lebanese way, speaking fluent, if slightly alien, versions of French, English, and Arabic. In Ireland, we'd mutter asides to each other in French and feel that this betokened something important. I had no idea his family was worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Now he ordered one drink after another. Like a couple of old actuaries, we could not avoid surveying the various outcomes that long-lost friends or near friends had met with. Eddie, with his Facebook account, was much more up to speed than I. From him, I learned that one poor soul had had two autistic children, and that another had intentionally fallen into traffic from an overpass near Dublin Airport. As he talked, I was confronted with a strangely painful idiosyncratic memory, how, during the rugby season, a vast, chaotic crowd periodically filled the street on which our house was situated, and, seemingly by a miracle of arithmetic, went without residue into the stadium at the top of the road, a fateful mass subtraction that would make me think, with my youngster's lavish melancholy, of our species' brave collective merriness in the face of death. Out of the stadium came from time to time the famous Irish refrain, "Alive, alive-o! Alive, alive-o!" Obviously, I did not share this flashback with Eddie. He removed a pair of sunglasses from his breast pocket and very ceremoniously put them on. "You've got to be kidding me," I said. The young Eddie had ridiculously worn these very shades at all times, even indoors. He was one of those guys for whom Top Gun was a big movie. Eddie said,
"Oh yes, I'm still rocking the aviators."
He said,
"Remember that standoff with the statistics professor?"
I remembered. This man had forbidden Eddie from wearing shades to his lectures. The interdiction had crushed Eddie. His shades were fitted with lenses for his myopia. Having to wear regular spectacles would have destroyed him.
"He'll throw me out of the class."
I said,
"Let him. You want to wear shades? Wear shades."
"What's he saying? He gets to decide what you wear?"
"Eddie, sometimes you've got to draw a line in the sand."
Line in the sand? What was I talking about? What did I know about lines in the sand? Young Eddie declared,
"Je vous ai compris."
He persisted in wearing his sunglasses. The lecturer did nothing about it.
"That was a real lesson,"
Eddie told me at Asia de Cuba.
"Fight them on the beaches, fight them on the landing grounds."
Removing the Ray-Bans, he preserved them as a talisman now, and had a collection of hundreds of tinted bifocals for day-to-day use. On his travels, he personally hand-carried his shades in a customized photographer's briefcase. Eddie told me that he'd taken over from his father the running of various Batros enterprises. In return, I told him a little about my own situation. Either I was more revealing than I'd thought, or Eddie Batros was now something of a psychologist, because soon afterward he wrote to me with a job offer. He stated that he'd wanted for some time to appoint a Batros family trustee.
"To keep an eye on our holdings, trusts, investment portfolios, etc."
We've just heard The Dog by Joseph O'Neill. Upon becoming a new mother, Eula Biss addresses a chronic condition of fear. Fear of the government, the medical establishment, and what is in your child's air, food, mattress, medicine, and vaccines. She finds that you cannot immunize your child or yourself from the world. In On Immunity and Inoculation, Biss investigates the metaphors and myths surrounding our conception of immunity and its implications for the individual and the social body. As she hears more and more fears about vaccines, Biss researches what they mean for her own child, her immediate community, America, and the world. Tamara Marston narrates.
I cannot now decipher the entries I made in a notebook then. Long lists of times, some of them only minutes apart. Obscure notations next to the times indicate, I think, waking, sleeping, nursing, and crying. I was searching for a pattern, trying to determine what made my baby cry inconsolably. What made him cry, I would learn much later, was an intolerance to cow's milk. Offending proteins from the milk I drank passed through my milk to him, a possibility that had not occurred to me. By the end of the summer, the evening news was running footage of people wearing white surgical masks in airports. The novel influenza virus was officially pandemic at that point. Churches were serving holy wafers on toothpicks, and airlines were removing pillows and blankets from their flights. What surprises me now is how unremarkable this seemed to me at the time. It all became part of the landscape of new motherhood, where ordinary objects like pillows and blankets have the power to kill a newborn. Colleges were daily sterilizing every high-touch surface, while I was nightly boiling every object my child put in his mouth. It was as if the nation had joined me in the paranoia of infant care. Like so many other mothers, I had been informed of a syndrome affecting infants that had no warning signs and no symptoms other than sudden death. Perhaps this is why, despite everything, I do not remember feeling particularly scared of the flu. It was just one concern of many. There was lead paint, I knew, on my walls, and hexavalent chromium in my water, and the books I was reading were telling me to run a fan while my baby slept, because even stagnant air could suffocate him. When I search now for a synonym for protect, my thesaurus suggests, after shield and shelter and secure, one final option, inoculate. This was the question when my son was born. Would I inoculate him? As I understood it then, this was not a question of whether I would protect him, so much as it was a question of whether inoculation was a risk worth taking. Would I enter into a gamble, like Thetis dipping the infant Achilles into the river Styx? The mothers I knew began debating whether or not to vaccinate our children against the novel influenza virus long before any vaccine became available to us. We were hearing that what made this particular strain of flu dangerous was that it was new to humans, like the virus that caused the Spanish flu epidemic of 1918, in which more than 50 million people died. But then we were also hearing that the vaccine had been produced hurriedly and that it might not have been fully tested. One mother told us that she had miscarried while she was sick with the seasonal flu and, being wary of any flu now, she planned to vaccinate. Another mother said that her child had screamed frighteningly all night following her first vaccination and she would not risk another vaccination of any kind. Every exchange about the new flu vaccine was an extension of the already existing discussion about immunization, in which all that is known of disease is weighed against all that is unknown about vaccines. As the virus spread, a mother I knew in Florida reported that her entire family had just had the H1N1 flu, and it was not any worse than a bad cold. Another mother in Chicago told me that her friend's healthy 19-year-old son had suffered a stroke after being hospitalized with the flu. I believed both of these stories, but they told me nothing more than what the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention already seemed to be trying to tell me. The flu could be harmless in some cases and serious in others. Under the circumstances, vaccination began to seem prudent. My baby was just over 6 months old, and I had just returned to work at a large university where the majority of my students would be coughing by the last week of classes.
That was On Immunity by Eula Biss. On December 3, 1976, just before the Jamaican general election, and 2 days before Bob Marley was to play the Smile Jamaica concert, gunmen stormed his house, machine guns blazing. The attack nearly killed the reggae star, his wife, and his manager, and it injured several others. Marley would go on to perform at the concert on December 5th, but he left the country the next day, not to return for 2 years. Deftly spanning decades and continents and peopled with a wide range of characters, assassins, journalists, drug dealers, and even ghosts, Marlon James' A Brief History of Seven Killings is the fictional exploration of that dangerous and unstable time and its bloody aftermath. From the streets and slums of Kingston in the 1970s, to New York's crack wars in the 1980s, and to a radically altered Jamaica of the 1990s. An ensemble cast performs the book.
I knew I was 14. That me know. I also know that too many people talk too much, especially the American, who never shut up, just switch to a laugh every time him talk about you. And it sounds strange how he put your name beside people we never hear about. Ayende Lumumba, a name that sound like a country that Kunta Kinte come from. The American, most of the time, hide him eye with sunglasses like he's a preacher from America come to talk to black people. Him and the Cuban come sometimes together, sometimes on their own. And when one talk, the other always quiet. The Cuban don't f*** with guns because guns always need to be needed, him say. And I know me used to sleep on a cot. And I know that my mother was a whore and my father was the last good man in the ghetto. And I know we watch a big house on Hope Road for days now. And at one point, you come talk to us like you was Jesus and we was Iscariot. And you nod as if to say, get on with your business and do what you have to do. But I can't remember if me see you Or if somebody told me that him see you so, that me think I see it too. You stepping out on the back porch, eating a slice of breadfruit. She coming out of nowhere like she have serious business outside at that time of night, and shocked. So shocked that you don't have no clothes on. Then she reach for your fruit because she want to eat it, even though Rasta don't like when woman loose. And you both get to midnight raving, and I grab myself and rave too. From either seeing it or hearing it, and then you write a song about it. The boy from Concrete Jungle, on the same girly green scooter come by for 4 days at 8 in the morning and 4 in the evening for the brown envelope until the new security squad start to turn him back. We know about that business too. In the 8 lanes and in Copenhagen City, all you can do is watch. Sweet talking voice on the radio say that crime and violence are taking over the country, and if change ever going to come, then we will have to wait and see. But all we can do down here in the 8 lanes is see and wait. And I see water run free down the street and I wait. And I watch my father get so sick and tired of her that he beat her like a dog. And I see the zinc on the roof rust itself brown. And then the rain bat a hole into it like foreign cheese. And I see 7 people in one room and 1 pregnant and people f***ing anyway. Because people so poor that they can't even afford shame. And I wait. And the little room gets smaller and smaller. And more sister, brother, cousin come from country. The city getting bigger and bigger. And there be no place to rub a dub or cut your and no chicken back to curry. And even when there is, it still costs too much money. And that little girl gets stabbed because they know she get lunch money every Tuesday. And the boys like me getting older and not in school very regular and can't read Dick and Jane, but no Coca-Cola. And want to go to a studio and cut a tune and sing hit songs and ride the rhythm out of the ghetto. But Copenhagen City and the 8 lanes both too big. And every time you reach the edge move ahead of you like a shadow until the whole world is a ghetto and you wait. I see you hungry and waiting, and know that it's just luck. You loafing around the studio and Desmond Decker telling the man to give you a break. And he give you the break because he hear the hunger in your voice before he even hear you sing. You cut a tune, but not a hit song. Too pretty for the ghetto even then. For we pass the time when prettiness make anybody's life easy. We see you hustle and trying to talk your way 12 inches taller, and we want to see you fail. And we know nobody would want you to be a rude boy anyway, for you look like a schemer. And when you disappear to Delaware and come back, you try sing the ska, but ska already left the ghetto to take up residence uptown. Ska take the plane to foreign to show white people that it's just like the twist. Maybe that make the Syrian and the Lebanese proud.
That was a sampling of A Brief History of 7 Killings by Marlon James. James McBride is the author of the classic memoir, The Color of Water, and the acclaimed novels Miracle at St. Anna and Song Yet Sung. A graduate of Oberlin College, James went on to receive a master's degree in journalism from New York's Columbia University. He worked as a staff writer for the Boston Globe, People magazine, and the Washington Post. His work has appeared in Essence, Rolling Stone, and the New York Times. His April 2007 National Geographic story entitled Hip Hop Planet is considered a respected treatise on African American music and culture. A talented musician, James has written songs for Anita Baker, Grover Washington Jr., among others, and is the recipient of major awards for his work as a composer in musical theater. He's collaborated on films with director Spike Lee, including Miracle at St. Anna and Red Hook Summer. McBride holds several honorary doctorates and is currently a distinguished writer in residence at New York University. Today we'll chat with James about his title, The Good Lord Bird, winner of the 2013 National Book Award. Welcome, James. I'm thrilled to have you with us on The Book Report.
We're delighted to be here.
What is the significance of the title, The Good Lord Bird?
Well, the good Lord Bird was an ivory-billed woodpecker that was that existed during the 1800s. That's said to be extinct now, but it was so big that when people saw it, they'd say, good Lord. He stitched into this novel as a kind of symbol of God's power. And that's how the book got its title, and that's where I got it from.
All right. Why did you choose to write a novel about John Brown now?
I don't know. I think books choose you, you know? I stumbled onto his story one day. I was in Maryland researching another book, and I saw a reference to him. And so I just simply drove down to Harper's Ferry, where he had his great attack against, you know, John Brown was a white guy who was against slavery, and he decided to, you know, attack slavery by attacking America's biggest arsenal, which was at Harper's Ferry, in what was then Virginia and what is now West Virginia. Mm-hmm. So I went to visit there, and I was just fascinated with the story. Here you have this guy who, along with 19 others, who decides, it would be like me climbing into a tank and attacking the Pentagon because I'm at odds with some American policy, you know.
Yeah.
It was just a suicide mission.
Right.
But I was fascinated with him because he was very religious and he was very, you know, he didn't smoke, he didn't drink, he was a family guy, he was a farmer, you know.
Right.
So I just became fascinated, and it was all about figuring out how to tell the story then.
You know, it was really interesting because in the book, the reader never really gets a feeling if you think he was a zealot or crazy.
I admire him for his convictions. But, you know, I couldn't have done what he did. Mm-hmm. You know, it's easy to look back in history and say, you know, well, if I was a slave, I would have beat up every white person. Or if I was a slave and I was white, I would have freed my slaves. I mean, you know, that doesn't mean anything. And so, you know, you look at people who were there and did what you wish you would have done. And in examining them, you kind of see how that world was. And it makes you respect them more and look at what you would have done and see that you probably wouldn't have done much.
Hmm.
I mean, we're all victim of the society that we grow up in. You know, we're all part of that, you know, cultural milieu wherever we come, you know, however we come in. And that's generally how we go out.
You know, one thing that amazed me about The Good Lord Bird is the cadence of your writing. From the early pages on, the dialogue moves in a rhythm that, for me, captured the time brilliantly. Were there any qualities of your music that you bring to your writing?
Well, I mean, there's an improvisatory quality to writing that relates to music in some ways. I mean, in music, you have to have the technical skill in order to be able to improvise and to stay in the right key and to move when the harmonies move and to play the proper elements that fall within the framework of the chord or the chord progressions that you're working in. But then, and essentially, you end up creating a new melody and a new song within the framework of that old song. And in that regard, The Good Lord Bird has a lot of improvisation in it because the John Brown story has been told many ways by many people, and many of them are very good writers, and I needed to figure out a way to tell it that was different.
How did you research the speech pattern of your Civil War era characters? It was so spot on.
Well, I you know, first of all, I grew up in a house where people talk like that. I mean, I grew up in New York, but all my relatives grew up in the South. And all my neighbors and all my friends' parents, you know, they all grew up from the South. New York, when in the 60s, in black New York, it was all people from the South. And from Texas and South Carolina and North Carolina and Florida. And, you know, everybody's mother seemed to be that, like they were from Alabama. So that was part of it. And then I just, you know, researched first-person narratives of slaves and whites from the era and, you know, railroad books and all kinds of stuff. People, it's there. You know, once it's there, once you kind of get it in your head and you put it in the character's mouth and they start to kind of talk it, you fall into it. You know, it just kind of gets in your bloodstream. It takes a while, though. It took me a long time. The language of the book probably took me the longest to get straight than anything else. only because I wanted it to flow properly and to be easy to read, but and funny at the same time. And, you know, so I rewrote a lot. I rewrote a lot with that, with the Good Lord Bird.
We're speaking with James McBride on the Book Report. Can you introduce us to Henry Shackelford?
Well, Henry Shackelford is a 10-year-old kid who's working in the tavern in Kansas Territory in 1856 when John Brown walks in. And John Brown walks in, and he gets into a fight with the tavern owner. Everyone pulls their sidearms, and a gunfight ensues. And in the chaos, John Brown snatches Henry out, thinks he's taking a 10-year-old girl to freedom because he thinks Henry's a girl. So he, and Henry, thinking that this crazy white guy is just nuts, just plays along. And so he has to pretend to be a girl throughout the entire narrative.
What's your reaction to several reviewers who liken Henry to Huck Finn?
Well, I mean, whatever they're sipping, I hope they keep sipping it. I think that's, it's a wonderful comparison, but, you know, comparing one of my characters to Mark Twain is like comparing, you know, Dave Koz, the saxophone player, to John Coltrane, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, Dave Koz is a pretty good saxophone player, but John Coltrane is, and he's a noun, you know. He's like house, car, Coltrane, you know, bed. And Dave Koz is a very good saxophone player. And I might be a pretty good writer, but I'm not in the same category as someone like, you know, Mark Twain or Toni Morrison or William Faulkner. I like it, but, you know, I'm not going to say take it back. You know, it makes you buy the book, good, but, you know, it's not Mark Twain.
You know, in the book, you write about John Brown's meeting with Frederick Douglass. Did this actually occur?
Yes, that meeting occurred, and it occurred pretty much as it's pretty close to the way it's portrayed in the book. John Brown was, and Frederick Douglass were very good friends. Frederick Douglass knew John Brown was going to attack Harper's Ferry, and they met in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, not far from Harper's Ferry, and John Brown begged Frederick Douglass to join him at Harper's Ferry, thinking that if Douglass joined, many more blacks would come. And Douglass basically said, I can't do it because it's a suicide mission. And he didn't do it. And it was a suicide mission. But John Brown was very disappointed about that. And he never, to my knowledge, never spoke Douglass's name ever again.
And did Brown actually meet with Harriet Tubman as well?
Yes, he did. He surely did. And Harriet Tubman was supposed to come to Harper's Ferry, and I think the only reason why she couldn't come was because they got the dates wrong. That's the problem with John Brown. He never got anything quite right. You know, he was always about 75% on the dot, and the other 25% was, like, somewhere else. But they had to attack Harper's Ferry a week early because they were found out by local authorities.
I see.
And so that was one reason why Harriet Tubman wasn't there. But she promised him she'd come. He had a lot of respect for Harriet Tubman. He called her General Tubman. I've been working on a TV show for FX that's based on Harriet Tubman. You know, if it comes to fruition, then I suspect that people would be a little more tuned into who she was.
Well, James, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, delighted. Thank you for having me.
Alrighty. With The Blazing World, best-selling author Siri Hustvedt returns to the New York art world. Siri, who's long been celebrated for her lyrical prose, tells the provocative story of the artist Harriet Burden. After years of watching her work ignored or dismissed by critics, Burden conducts an experiment she calls maskings. She presents her own art, obscured behind three male masks, concealing her female identity. The three solo shows are successful, but when Burden finally steps forward triumphantly to reveal herself as the artist behind the exhibitions, there are critics who doubt her. The public scandal turns on the final exhibition, initially shown as the work of the acclaimed artist Rune, who denies Burden's role in its creation. What no one doubts, however, is that the two artists were intensely involved with each other. As Burden's journals reveal, she and Rune found themselves locked in a dangerous game that ended with the man's bizarre death. The Blazing World, performed by Patricia Rodriguez and Eric Myers, is an intricately conceived, diabolical puzzle that explores the deceptive powers of prejudice, money, fame, and desire.
Although Burden had exhibited her work in New York City in the 1970s and 80s, she had been disappointed by its reception and had withdrawn from the art world altogether. Sometime in the late 90s, she began an experiment that took her 5 years to complete. According to Brickman, Burden engaged 3 men to act as fronts for her own creative work. 3 solo shows in 3 New York galleries attributed to Anton Tisch, 1998, Phineas Q. Eldridge, 2002, and the artist known only as Rune, 2003, had actually been made by Burden. She titled the project as a whole Maskings, and declared that it was meant not only to expose the anti-female bias of the art world, but to uncover the complex workings of human perception and how unconscious ideas about gender, race, and celebrity influence a viewer's understanding of a given work of art. But Brickman went further. He argued that Burden insisted that the pseudonym she adopted changed the character of the art she made. In other words, the man she used as a mask played a role in the kind of art she produced. Each artist mask became, for Burden, a poetized personality, a visual elaboration of a hermaphroditic self, which cannot be said to belong to either her or to the mask, but to a mingled reality created between them. As a professor of aesthetics, I was immediately fascinated by the project for its ambition, but also for its philosophical complexity and sophistication. At the same time, Brickman's letter puzzled me. Why hadn't Burden published her own statement? Why would she allow Brickman to speak for her? Brickman claimed that the 60-page letter Burden called Missive from the Realm of Fictional Being had arrived unannounced in his mailbox and that he had no knowledge of the artist beforehand. The tone of Brickman's letter is also curious. It alternates between condescension and admiration. He criticizes Burden's letter as hyperbolic and unsuited for publication in an academic journal, but then quotes other passages he attributes to her with seeming approval. I was left with a muddled impression of the letter, as well as a feeling of irritation with Brickman, whose commentary effectively smothers Burden's original text. I immediately looked up the 3 exhibitions. The History of Western Art by Tisch, The Suffocation Rooms by Eldridge, and Beneath by Rune, each of which was visually distinct from the other 2. Nevertheless, I gleaned what I would call a family resemblance among the 3. The Tisch, Eldridge, and Rune shows Burden had allegedly invented were all compelling as art, but I was especially intrigued by Burden's experiment because it resonated with my own intellectual concerns. My teaching schedule was heavy that year. I had duties as temporary chair of my department, and I wasn't able to satisfy my curiosity about maskings until 3 years later, when I took a sabbatical leave to work on my book, Plural Voices in Multiple Visions, in which I discussed the work of Soren Kierkegaard, M.M. Bakhtin, and the art historian Abby Warburg. Brickman's description of Burden's project and her poetized personalities, the latter expression is Kierkegaard's, meshed perfectly with my own thoughts. So I decided to track Brickman down through the open eye and hear what he had to say for himself.
That was The Blazing World by Siri Hustvedt. From Dina Mengestu, a recipient of the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 Award, the New Yorker's 20 Under 40 Award, and a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant, comes All Our Names, a novel about exile and the loneliness and fragmentation of lives that straddle countries. A young man comes of age during an African revolution. He is drawn from the university into the intensifying clamor of the streets outside. But as the line between idealism and violence becomes increasingly blurred, and the path of revolution leads to almost certain destruction, he leaves his country for America. There, pretending to be an exchange student, he falls in love with a social worker and settles into the routine of small-town life. Yet, the secrets of his past will not stay hidden. Saskia Marleveld and Corey Jackson perform the book.
I arrived in the capital poorly prepared. I had read the same Victorian novels a dozen times, and I assumed that was how proper English was spoken. I said, "Sir," constantly. No one I met believed I was a revolutionary, and I didn't have the heart to claim I wanted to be a writer. Until I met Isaac, I hadn't made a single friend. With my long, skinny legs and narrow face, he said I looked more like a professor than a fighter. And in the beginning, that was what he called me. Professor, or the professor. The first, but not the last name with which he christened me. "And what about you?" I asked him. I assumed that, like others, he had another, more public name that he wanted to be known by. He was shorter but wider than me, each of his arms tightly laced with muscles and veins that ran like scars the length of his forearms. He had the build but not the face and demeanor of a soldier. He smiled and laughed too often for me to imagine he could ever hurt someone. "For now, Isaac is it," he said. Isaac was the name his parents had given him. And until it was necessary for us to flee the capital, the only name he wanted. His parents had died in the last round of fighting that came just before independence. Isaac was their legacy to him. And when his revolutionary dreams came to an end and he had to choose between leaving and staying, that name became his last and most precious gift to me. From the beginning, it was harder for Isaac than for me to be in the capital. This had never been, and I understood later, would never be my home, regardless of what I imagined. It was different for Isaac, however. Uganda was his country, and Kampala was the heart of it. His family was from the north, one of the tall, darker tribes that a man in Cambridge had decided were more warrior-like than their smaller cousins to the south. Had the British stayed, he would have done well. He had been bright enough in his early years to be talked of as one of the students who, when older, could be sent abroad, perhaps to a public school in London on a government scholarship. But then the whole colonial experiment ended in what seemed like a single long bloody afternoon. And boys like Isaac were orphaned a second time. And although Isaac had arrived in the capital only a few weeks before me, he knew enough about it from rumors and stories to assume he would easily find his place in it, and then rise to the top of whatever circle he found himself in. The fact that he was poor and completely unknown when we met was his most obvious well of frustration. But I suspected there were other sources of anger and heartbreak that he had yet to acknowledge.
We've just heard All Our Names by Dina Mengestu. Days in September by Lawrence Wright is a gripping day-by-day account of the 1978 Camp David Conference, when President Jimmy Carter persuaded Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin and Egyptian President Anwar Sadat to sign the first peace treaty in the modern Middle East. With his razor-sharp insight into the forces at play and his journalistic skill, Wright takes us through each of the 13 days of Camp David, illuminating the issues that made the problems of the region so intractable. Wright also draws vivid portraits of the other fiery personalities present at Camp David, including Moshe Dayan, Osama Elbaz, and Zbigniew Brzezinski, as they work furiously behind the scenes. Wright also explores the significant role played by Rosalynn Carter. What emerges is a riveting view of the making of this unexpected and unprecedented peace, and spotlights the full extent of Carter's persistence in pushing forward the agreement. Mark Bramwell narrates.
The resulting profiles of Begin and Sadat drew sharply opposing portraits. Sadat was a visionary, bold, reckless, and willing to be flexible as long as he believed his overall goals were being achieved. He saw himself as a grand strategic thinker, blazing like a comet through the skies of history. The CIA noted his penchant for publicity, terming it his Barbara Walters syndrome, after the famous television personality. But by the time the profile was prepared for Carter, that category had been upgraded to Sadat's Nobel Prize complex. Begin, on the other hand, was secretive, legalistic, and leery of radical change. History for Begin was a box full of tragedy. One shouldn't expect to open it without remorse. When put under stress, Sadat drifted into generalities, and Begin clung to minutiae. Clashes and misunderstandings were bound to occur. There was some doubt among the analysts preparing the dossiers whether two such opposing personalities should ever be put into the same room together. The two leaders seemed alike only in unpromising ways. Both men had blood on their hands. They had each spent long stretches in prison and in hiding, and were deeply schooled in conspiracy. They were not the kind of men Carter had ever known before. Carter believed he instinctively understood Sadat, however, even though they came from distant cultures. Part of their bond was the fact that they had both been farmers. As a boy, Carter had plowed the red clay of southwest Georgia behind a mule, feeling the damp cool of the freshly turned earth between his toes. He was struck by the observation that Jesus and Moses would have felt at home on a farm in the deep south during the first part of the 20th century. Around the globe, but on the same meridian as Plains, Georgia, there is a village of mud huts in Egypt called Mit Abul Qum, where Sadat spent his early years. Farmers in the black alluvial soil of the Nile Delta irrigated their fields using an Archimedes screw, which the Greek sage reputedly invented when he visited Egypt in the 3rd century BCE. One could see painted in the tombs of the pharaohs scenes of village life that were still being lived 3,000 years later. Changelessness is the essential feature of such rural childhoods, a feeling of being cocooned, at once protected and entrapped. And yet, even as a child, a dark-skinned peasant from a small village in the Nile Delta, Sadat sensed his unique role in Egyptian society. Once, when he was playing with some other children near an irrigation canal, they jumped into the water and Anwar leaped in after them. Only then did he remember that he couldn't swim. He thought, "If I drown, Egypt will have lost Anwar Sadat." Although he rarely talked about his race, Sadat was only two generations away from slavery. His maternal grandfather, an African man called Kerala, had been brought as a slave to Egypt and was emancipated only after the British occupiers demanded the practice be abolished. Kerala's daughter, Sitt el Bahrain, woman of two banks, was also a black African. She was chosen as a wife for Mohammed el Sadati, an interpreter for a British medical group. Anwar Sadat dropped the final Y of his family name after the 1952 revolution. She covered herself in traditional black clothing with long sleeves and a skirt that reached the floor. She was Mohammed's sixth wife, The first five bore him no children, so he divorced them, one after another. Sitt el-Bahrain would bear him three sons and a daughter. Anwar was her second child.
We've just heard 13 Days in September by Lawrence Wright. Readers, it's during these December days that we realize once again, time is our most precious commodity. It's been my pleasure to bring you worthy title suggestions that may not have been on your reading list. For more ideas across the spectrum, be sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.